First of all, Matthew, thank you very much for taking my interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me start by talking about China's third aircraft carrier. As we know, China launched its third aircraft carrier called Fujian back in June. Have you been monitoring through satellite images or any other data the progress of Fujian since its launch?
That's a great question. We certainly have been keeping an eye on all of China's aircraft carriers. This is important to the research that we do at CSIS. So even early on, before it looked like an aircraft carrier, we were watching it through satellite imagery and other intelligence to try to understand what that process looked like and when it might launch. There's a lot going on right now, and that's to be expected. Once an aircraft carrier or any large surface combatant launches, that's really just the first step in getting it operational. You get it into the water, and you still have a lot of work to do with fitting out systems, both outside the vessel on the flight deck, so you can see some changes in terms of radars being installed or weapon systems being installed. But a lot of the interesting stuff is actually happening inside the vessel itself. And unfortunately, I don't have a pass to get in there and see exactly what's going on. But at this stage, after a vessel launches, you know, the next 12 months, sometimes longer, sometimes a little bit less, is the fitting out process, where a lot of new systems are being installed, a lot of new systems are being brought online. And for China, with the 003, it's a new platform, right? This is the first time they've built an aircraft carrier like this. So we can expect them to take their time, go through the process, and really figure out all the little nuances of the vessel before it's ready to begin sea trials.
Have you noticed any major changes? I'm asking because there have been reports like, you know, the AirPower radar and some guns are removed. Were you able to see these changes?
We actually saw some of that happening with what was being posted on social media more than with satellite imagery. You know, one of the challenges with satellite imagery is that you don't necessarily get a shot at every single moment when you really want to see what's going on. But we have seen a lot of activity on social media. But that's not really something to necessarily be worried about. This is a normal part of the process in building a surface combatant or building any real ship, is that once it's put in the water, you have to start installing systems. And for China, it's the first time it's doing it with this platform. So you can expect to see some things being installed and then things being moved, potentially components having to be adjusted a little bit before they're ready to begin sea trials. So yes, there's work happening, but we can't read too much into that because this is, again, a normal part of the process in putting an aircraft carrier into the water, fitting it out, and then preparing it for sea trials.
Some analysts say China's third craft carrier is aimed at a post-US Asia, quote unquote. What is your take?
I think there's a little bit of flawed thinking with the premise of a post-US Asia. Now, the United States isn't going anywhere, and it's not going to all of a sudden step back from its commitments to its allies and partners in the region. So the idea of a post-US Asia, I think, is a little bit of a misnomer. You can certainly imagine a future world or a future environment in which U.S. resources are a little bit more strained than they are now, where U.S. credibility has maybe eroded in terms of providing a security blanket in the region. And in that kind of environment, it certainly provides China with a freer hand to operate. But that has more to do with the broader geopolitical environment or broader international relations than it really does with just one type of vessel. You know, it's just one part of China's Navy. It's one part of China's naval modernization. So could we be, you know, moving in a direction of a world in which China is able to have a little bit more of a freer hand in operating in the region? Certainly. Could its aircraft carriers be part of that? Certainly. But there's not really, at least in my assessment, going to be a post-US Asia in the sense that the US won't be a major factor in the region.
Technically, how far or wide can Fujian project power from its home base?
Yeah, this is a question that's getting asked a lot in terms of trying to understand what the range or what the endurance is of China's new aircraft carrier. And there's a few things that you have to really think about or try to think through that process, right? We don't have perfect clarity on it, but there's a few hints that we can start to understand what that might look like. So the first is that all of China's aircraft carriers are conventionally powered, right? And that's the first factor when you're thinking about what the endurance is or what the range is of an aircraft carrier. So if you look at China's earlier aircraft carrier, the 002, the Shandong, that has a range, estimated range of around 25,000 kilometers, right, because it's still conventionally powered. We can expect something similar for the 003. China might move eventually in the direction of having nuclear propulsion for its aircraft carriers. That's certainly something that they are exploring, but it's a difficult technology to master. So we're really not quite there yet. But that number, again, doesn't tell us everything, right? So if you think about an aircraft carrier, you think about a U.S. supercarrier, for instance, sure, nuclear-powered propulsion, which theoretically allows it to stay at sea forever, but there's still a crew on board, and that crew needs to be fed, that crew needs water, and so that limits, again, how long a vessel can stay at sea. The other factor are the support vessels. Aircraft carriers don't go anywhere on their own. They're escorted by a number of different types of vessels, some that are meant to augment the power of an aircraft carrier, some that are meant to help support it, refit it, and all of those different things. And those vessels tend to be and will continue to be conventionally powered. And so those factor into the equation as well. So when you take a step back and kind of look through that and try to get a sense of, okay, well, what does that actually mean if China wants to carry out missions with its aircraft carriers deeper into the Indian Ocean or deeper into the Pacific Ocean, maybe somewhere closer to the Middle East? Well, you have to start thinking about where it might be able to refuel, refit, and port its vessels, right? So if you think about Djibouti, for instance, like that's a location where China has the ability to dock an aircraft carrier and refuel and refit it. And so when you look elsewhere, you have to start asking, well, where would China want to start thinking about locations further into the Pacific, for instance, or in other locations in South and Southeast Asia, where it would be able to conduct those type of refueling operations?
Given all these considerations you just mentioned, in your opinion, what is the main purpose that Fujian has been designed for?
So what is the main purpose, I think you could ask, of an aircraft carrier in a broader sense? And there's a few things really to take into consideration. One is that, you know, China has undergone a fundamental reorganization and modernization of its Navy, and it's put carrier operations at the forefront of what it's doing. It's certainly not the only thing that it's doing, but aircraft carriers are expensive investments, right? So they are clearly looking at the external environment and understanding that for what they perceive to be as a peer competitor of the United States, or they desire to be a peer competitor with the United States, that aircraft carriers are the foundation of how the U.S. projects power further afield. So there's certainly that component of it, right? So aircraft carrier enables China to operate in its near seas, but then also operate further and further away from the Chinese mainland. Now, what purpose it's going to be used for, that depends. The whole concept behind an aircraft carrier is that it's a flexible platform, and it can be brought into any number of types of environments and execute any number of different types of missions. Those can range from humanitarian assistance and disaster relief to conducting airstrikes overseas. And I don't think we can fully understand how China might want to leverage its aircraft carriers in any capacity yet, because it hasn't really gotten to that stage. But it's building up its capability to have a flexible answer to different types of scenarios. So that part's a little bit hard to predict. But we do know that China seeks to insert itself in the region, to be more of a power broker in the region. And aircraft carriers are a really important way that countries can go about doing that, especially when you think about smaller countries in the region that are used to seeing the U.S. as the sort of omnipresent force, the security blanket in the region. Having capable aircraft carriers allows China to begin to challenge that.
Let's talk a little bit about the so-called GSSC, China's major shipbuilding state-owned enterprise, China State Shipbuilding Corporation. CSSC was blacklisted, quote-unquote, by the Trump administration. Any major changes so far since Biden was sworn in?
Not really in terms of what U.S. approach is to CSSC or any of the other major companies that were identified during the Trump administration as being integral to the PLA and to the PLA's modernization. That same approach has been maintained by the Biden administration. As far as, you know, connections and ties between U.S. companies and CSSC, they're not as present or not as obvious as you might think. You know, the U.S. isn't a major player in the shipbuilding or the shipping industry, at least not the same way as a lot of Asian maritime powers are. So the most likely connection you'd see between CSSC directly with the U.S. would be a merchant vessel built by CSSC ferrying goods to a U.S. port. But there's a perceptional component here that's really important and really critical. Even if the U.S. or U.S. firms don't really do business with CSSC, it certainly sends a message across the globe to allies and partners that this is a company that is driven by, of course, commercial gains, but also to help support China's military and its modernization. And so you have to be cautious and careful with doing business with that kind of entity.
Have you seen any effects by this Trump era measures, like so-called blacklisting?
It depends a little bit on the specific company that you're looking at. CSSC's operations haven't fundamentally changed, and a large part of that's because the U.S. isn't a major player in the markets in which CSSC operates.
Matthew, you recently published a piece about how foreign companies help modernize China's Navy. Tell us something more.
Yeah, so there's a lot really to dig into the connections between CSSC and foreign companies and how potentially foreign capital can help drive China's military modernization. And China is the leading merchant shipbuilder in the world. So if you actually look at the industry, it's pretty condensed, and China, you know, controls around 40% of that market. So just have a thought, you know, think about the port of Los Angeles or think about any port that you've been to, and you look at all the vessels that are out there that are ferrying goods back and forth. Around 40% of merchant vessels are built in China, and within that, 20% of them, or 20, 21, maybe 22% of them, are actually just built by CSSC. It's by far the largest shipbuilding company in the world in terms of tonnage of vessels produced. And they attract orders both domestically from Chinese shipping companies, but also from overseas shipping companies. And in a normal world in which you can fully understand and have full transparency into the operations of a company, that might not be all that much of a problem. But the issue with CSSC is that, and it's pretty bold in declaring this, it's a fundamental player in China's military modernization. A lot of the most modern naval vessels that you see getting produced in China for the PLA, those are getting built at CSSC-controlled shipyards by CSSC subsidiaries. And at those same subsidiaries, you're seeing merchant ships being built, again, for the domestic market, but where our research really focuses is on foreign vessels that are also being built there. So the same companies, the same shipyards that are signing contracts with, you know, Taiwan company or a company in France to build merchant vessels, they're also being tasked with constructing military vessels for the PLA. And that's where the challenge really lies, is that we can't understand the capital flows between those two different sides of business. They're so blurred, and they're purposely blurred. I mean, that's part of China's standard operating procedures for this kind of industry. And so it raises these really important questions, these really compelling questions about the degree to which foreign capital is flowing into these companies and how that trickles into the military space.
How does the CSSC represent the enormous risk China's military civil fusion presents to the security of the world?
Yeah, I don't think CSSC sees its activities in the military and the commercial space as being a risk. They actually actively promote that. If you look at their publicity, both CSSC, the parent company, and also the subsidiaries, look through their corporate filings, you look through their press releases, they actively promote that they are a player in the military space, that they're helping to drive military modernization forward in China, and that they're also active players in the commercial space, building larger and larger and more capable merchant vessels for clients that are both domestic and international. It even goes a step further than that. But if you're a foreign company looking to do business in China or looking to do business in the shipbuilding industry, it's certainly something that you have to take into account.
In one of the satellite images you have researched, Taiwan's Evergreen container ship is right next to China's aircraft carrier Fujian, or the so-called Type 003. And not just one, at least three. And Evergreen container ships are also close to 055 and 052D destroyers. What information were you able to read through this image? Does the fact that Evergreen is buying merchant ships from China constitute any security risks?
Yeah, so it's a really great question to understand. You know, we've observed Evergreen vessels being built at Jianong near Chinese warships and what the implications of that really are. The first thing that I would express is that it's not a one-off, right? This isn't just a one-time, we saw one image where this was happening. We've actually been observing this type of behavior at Jianong in particular for over a year, where we've seen Evergreen vessels being built in close proximity to Chinese warships. It's not just Taiwan. I don't want to just single them out, you know, Evergreen being a company based in Taiwan. We see other companies from Europe, Middle East, elsewhere, and Asia also being part of a system in which you see dual-use facilities being used to construct both military vessels and commercial vessels. And I'll just give a quick example of what I mean by that. So the dry dock where China put together its third aircraft carrier is the same dry dock where previously a container ship for the French, for a French company, was being constructed. And then what's that? Vessel was ready to be put into the water. All the prefabricated components of the Type 003 were brought over to the dry dock, and that's where work continued on it. At one point, we were looking at satellite imagery, and we noticed not only were there Evergreen vessels nearby on other dry docks, but the same dry dock where the carrier was, a caisson had been put up, and that helps to bifurcate the dry dock, and so you can work on more than one vessel at a time. And right next to the aircraft carrier, just the same exact same dry dock, just separated by a caisson, was a component being constructed for an Evergreen vessel. It eventually moved and was welded to the to another part of the ship. So what are the implications of that? Well, we know that this is an ongoing process at Chinese shipyards. And so if you're a company based outside of China and you're thinking about doing business with China, you need to understand that the same facilities, the same fabrication halls, in some cases, some of the same workers that might be working on your commercial vessel are also probably working on warships for the Chinese Navy. Now, if you're a company operating far away from China, if you're in Europe or maybe if you're in the Middle East, you might not necessarily see that as concerning. But for Taiwan, the risk is fairly acute, right? It's not that far away from Taiwan, and they have an ever-present fear of what China might do or how it might leverage its military to coerce Taiwan into certain types of actions. So in my view, it poses a pretty significant security threat in terms of how businesses from Taiwan think about their relationship with firms in China.
What should the international companies like Evergreen do to manage the risks if CSSC could provide better products at a lower price?
So, you know, foreign companies have a couple of options at least to think about here, and it's certainly not an easy challenge because when you're dealing with the shipbuilding industry, it's heavily concentrated in just a handful of companies, and those, a lot of them had to be in China, or they're in Japan, or they're in South Korea. So you don't have a lot of options, and there's very much a capacity issue you have to deal with as well. Major shipping companies are usually placing shipbuilding orders several years out, right, based on what their expectations are for what fleet size they need for, you know, carrying out their operations. And so it's a challenge. There's no easy answer here. But I think one step forward is to recognize that even if it appears as though you're doing business with a commercial entity in China, if it's involved in the shipbuilding industry, it probably has some ties to shipbuilding entities related to the PLA. And you need to ask whether or not you're comfortable with having that type of relationship. Again, you don't necessarily have a lot of options, but we're entering into a phase where the bottom line, right, the cost of the vessel itself or the revenue that you're trying to generate by putting more ships into the water can't be the only factor that you're thinking about when you're worrying about the broader geopolitical context. Some companies and some industries can think that way, where the bottom line is really the only decision that they need to be concerned about. But broader national security interests come into play. And, you know, the United States can't determine what companies are going to do around the globe. But we can shed a light on these problematic connections and leave it to those countries and those companies to make a determination about what path they feel is necessary to secure both their financial needs and their national security needs as well.
What could the United States do to, like you said, to incentivize those foreign companies to go to countries like Japan and South Korea instead of China?
First step, and I think this is the first step we're seeing in a lot of different industries, is transparency and openness, right? So if you take a step away from just the shipbuilding industry and you think about textiles, right, or you think about agricultural goods coming from Xinjiang or solar PV coming from Xinjiang and elsewhere in China, the first step is making people aware of what the problem is and then trying to put in place an infrastructure where companies can make the right decisions based on their own guidelines of how they need to operate. Now, obviously, with the shipbuilding industry, we're not dealing with human rights abuses in the same way we are in other industries that we deal with in China, but there is this baggage that comes with working in the shipbuilding industry and leaning on China's shipbuilding largesse to fulfill your needs. So the United States, it can't all of a sudden, you know, wave a magic wand and solve the problem, but it can start the conversation. It can also talk to companies in Japan and in South Korea and understand what they would need to do in order to increase their output, to increase their capabilities so that they are a more attractive market to companies coming from places like Taiwan or from France or from elsewhere in Europe.